Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Utah unveils plans to bring a nuclear hub to Brigham City. In water-strapped southern Utah, tighter limits may spell the end for new golf courses. And Utah's plan for a massive homeless shelter draws heat from advocates and community leaders. Joining me today on the program are Salt Lake Tribune water and land use reporter Leah Larson. Leah, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. We have reporter Brooke Larson as well with us. Brooke, thank you.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Hello. Thank you. And Westside Communities reporter Jose Davila IV is with us. Thank you, Jose.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Thank you. Let's start with Leah. Very interesting story about nuclear power. Of course, we know the governor, other state leaders, very pro-nuclear power. So what's going to be happening, Leah, in Brigham City?
Yeah, I think that state leaders would say they're pro all kinds of power, but they definitely made nuclear one of their priorities as we look for new sources of electricity generation. Brigham City, they kind of called this meeting up there this week with some mysterious announcement. We weren't sure what it was going to be, but what it sounds like is that the state has struck a deal with two companies called High Tech Solutions and one called Holtec International to build what they're calling kind of a nuclear hub in the Brigham City area. So that'll mean, yes, some nuclear reactor sites, some power generation plants, but also some sort of manufacturing facility where they're going to build these power plants. They're called small modular reactors. So they're going to build all the components for those so we can ship them all around the Intermountain West and build these kinds of reactors in other places and other states. So that is the plan as unveiled this week.
So they would manufacture these small nuclear plants, right? And they'd also have a couple of these plants in the area?
Yes, the plan calls for two of these small modular reactors in the Brigham City area, and each of those plants will have two units. So four units total, two plants, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So tell me about these small nuclear reactors. Have we had these? I recall might have been a different thing, but some Utah municipalities wanted to bring these, or at least draw power from some of these. That seemed to fall through a year or two ago.
Yeah, that's true. There's been a lot of chatter about them, and I do think they're interesting. You know, so they're supposed to be sort of a scaled down version of like the massive nuclear plants we probably think of, like at Fukushima and other places around our country and the world. But these are supposed to be smaller. Their TerraPower, which is this Bill Gates-backed startup, is currently building one actually in Kemmerer, Wyoming, where one of Pacificor's coal plants are. So there is one actively being built and coming online. And then Holtec International, one of the companies we're partnering with for this Brigham City development, is in the process of building one in Michigan at the Palisades nuclear plant. But of course, these are all a ways off. They won't come online for probably, you know, around a decade. So still plenty to watch. And, you know, we'll see if these proliferate around the West like some are expecting.
How much power can these put out?
So these ones proposed by Holtec for the Brigham City area, they call them their SMR 300s. So they produce 300 megawatts, and a megawatt is a million watts. I know it's hard to wrap your head around those kinds of units in energy production, but 300 megawatts per unit, I believe, is what they're calling for.
Are they safe? That's always it's always in the back of people's mind with
nuclear power.
That is
the burning question everybody has. Yeah, I think, there's been some nuclear disasters that have certainly grabbed headlines in, past and recent history. But, I think engineers are working on safety all the time. And, they say they've made all these improvements. They've developed safer fuels. So I know getting community buy-in is important for the Office of Energy Development. That's what they say. They don't want to build these plants in places where they're not welcome. And I do think public perception is shifting somewhat over the years as far as like some of those misconceptions or those fears on safety and things and what we do with waste storage. So I think we'd all like to hope and believe that our state leaders and things aren't going to build plants that aren't safe in the middle of communities. So time will tell. Yeah.
You mentioned waste storage. That's another big, of course, we have energy solutions here, but where would the waste go if we thought that far ahead?
That is another burning question. It's a good one. So my understanding is most, the nation's plan, and we have this in writing and in statute for the country, it's supposed to be a Yucca Mountain in Nevada, but politics kind of melted down. Oops, no pun intended. over that during the Obama administration, where it was just not politically palatable for the people of Nevada. So that all kind of got put way on the back burner, and it's not sure certain if it will ever restart again. So my understanding is what most plants are doing is just safely storing their waste materials on site. I mean, they'll ship maybe low level radioactive materials to facilities like the one Energy Solutions has in Clyde, but that's like the lowest of the low radiation. It's like a rag somebody maybe used to clean something up, or I think in the case of some waste Energy Solutions is looking to take from Canada, it would be like demolished concrete from a plant, not like within the highly radioactive reactor itself, but in the facility. So it's like the lowest of the low radioactive material. So that some of that goes to the Clyde facility, but a lot of this like more highly radioactive material is often stored on site in a secure facility. So that's kind of what we're doing as our temporary, which is turning into a long-term solution.
What about regulation? One of the knocks against the full power plants has been it takes years and years and years, and if ever, jump through regulatory hurdles.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah, I know the Trump administration is trying to kind of cut back some of that red tape. It's one of the, some of President Trump signed a bunch of executive orders over the spring calling to like kind of fast track some of those things. And I think that well, I don't think Governor Cox has openly said he's very supportive of this, fast tracking these kinds of projects while also making sure we keep community and environmental safety in mind. So we'll see if it actually materializes, but I think even removing the red tape, just the kind of engineering and things that goes into these, it's still going to take many, many years to build them and develop them and get them online.
One of the state officials mentioned data centers, a big power draw, right? That this could help with that. Where does this fit in? Is this a big part of the solution for the energy needs?
That was a big, if you're reading between the lines, if you read the event on Monday, there were a lot of veterans there. There was a lot of people with MIDA, which is Utah's Military Installation Development Authority. So kind of like a military veterans theme. And there was a lot of talk about how AI security is now becoming national security, like energy security is a component of national security. And there was a lot of talk about AI and how who whichever country becomes leader with AI will kind of be the leader of the world. It's like the new quote unquote arms race that Senate President Stuart Adams called he called it our new nuclear arms race. So I think the idea is that we have all these AI centers that are big suck on the grid. These things use a ton of power, especially as like these AI models get more and more sophisticated. It just uses a ton of energy. I'm sure we've all heard about that. So I think the idea, like the big idea, a grand idea here is that we'll have like maybe a campus of AI data centers fueled by one of these small modular reactors.
The officials were touting jobs. How many jobs do we think at the manufacturing plant and then at each of these reactors?
Good question. I have to pull up my story to get the exact numbers because they flew right out of my head. But I think it was a few hundred for the manufacturing facility and for the power plants, and then like a few thousand to build them. So those would be more temporary construction jobs, and then like ongoing jobs would be a couple hundred each at the plant and the manufacturing facility. So, for a semi-rural county like Box Elder, where Brigham City is located, that's a decent chunk of jobs for sure.
So a manufacturing plant would be producing these reactors. How many reactors do they think they want to build?
That's a great question. There's so many questions that we couldn't really answer right now, but The thought is that these things might be the future, not just for the Intermountain West, but maybe for the nation. So I think they're thinking we will be the hub for manufacturing them in the Intermountain West, and then they'll have some other facilities in other parts, other regions of the nation that will be doing the same to build these and deploy them. But we don't know how many. At least there's at least two planned for Brigham City. We know that.
So when do they hope this manufacturing plant will be up and running?
Yeah, good question. So these companies signed a non-binding memorandum of understanding with the state back in April. And what that MOU says is that they want a presence established by 2028. Now, what presence means, I'm not sure, but I would think that would be the manufacturing facility. And I know High Tech Solutions, one of the big things they're going to be doing is training up a workforce, which I know when you think of a nuclear power plant, you're thinking it's a bunch of nuclear engineers, but there's, all kinds of like plumbers, piper, pipe fitters, mechanical engineering, so all kinds of jobs that they're going to need for these things. So they're going to train up a workforce. That's going to take a few years. And then as far as the reactors go, what I heard was the whole tech wants its reactor, it's kind of first of its kind reactor to go online at that plant in Michigan first, and then perhaps Utah will be a few years later. So he's thinking like 2030s, early to mid 2030s, I think, is when the reactors will be live if all goes according to plan.
Oh, we'll see what happens. That's in the Brigham City area. I want to, before we go to the next segment, Leah, talk about another story of yours. Here's the headline: Feds take Wasatch Front off the National Dirty Air List for inversion smog. That's pretty big news. That seems like Wasatch Front has been on the dirty air list for a long, long time.
Oh yeah, it definitely has. Yeah, so we've been on the list since I think 2009, because the EPA kind of tightened up its air quality standards in 2006. They went into effect in 2009, and we've been in non-attainment on that dirty air list ever since until just now. So yeah, I think people who live on the Wasatch Front are very aware of our wintertime pollution challenges. It's never fun when you can see the air, but you can't see anything else, but the state has undertaken a lot of big initiatives in the last decade or so to clean up our smog in the winter. Chief among them, and I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with, are the wood burning bans in the winter. They're also counties have been cracking down on like diesel emissions. It used to be for a while, if you had a gas powered vehicle, you had to go get your emissions test every year, but diesel cars were exempt. So tightened up on that, and apparently it's made a difference and really cleaned up our air. So that's a small victory for public health and for air quality.
Now we're talking about the fine particulate matter at PM 2.5.
That's right, yeah. And that's kind of a great point. So yes, we're talking about particulate, PM 2.5, that really fine particulate that kind of can penetrate your lung tissue, get into your bloodstream, brain. It's really kind of nasty stuff. But while we've cleaned up that particulate pollution in our wintertime inversion smog, we're facing new air quality challenges kind of from all fronts. We have more wildfires because of a warming climate, a warming west, which creates smoke pollution. And that's not really regulated like our wintertime inversion is, because it's considered by the federal government as an exceptional event that we couldn't have done anything to prevent. So while those may become more frequent over time, it's not something we can get dinged over. And then we also have, of course, the Great Salt Lakes drying up and blowing dust around, and we're just starting to get our hands around what that means and where it's all going. And then, of course, we have our ongoing summertime ozone struggles. So there's still plenty of air quality battles to fight.
You talked to Brian Mensch, president of Utah Physicians for Healthy. It's UPHE. I can't remember what it stands for.
Utah Physicians for a Healthy
And
Environment.
healthy
Yeah.
environment. Yes,
Yes.
Dr. Mensch. I want to quote him here from your story. There's no safe level of air pollution exposure. Still work to be
Yeah.
done, he thinks.
Yeah, that's kind of been the drum that they've been beating, I think, since their formation, is that no amount of air pollution is good or healthy. And I think their position is that while it's good that Utah's air quality has improved, these non-attainment standards, developed by EPA are kind of a mix, not just of public health and science, but concessions to industry and politics. They have a lot of interest to weigh and kind of land on these numbers, but especially if you have pre-existing health conditions, of course, like you're even more sensitive to some of these air pollution events. So yeah, although we're in attainment, it doesn't mean we still won't get bouts of bad air. It doesn't mean that, like, when you do see that wintertime smog, that it's fine. Go breathe it in. So yeah, I think that's their position.
One more thing that interested me, can't remember who this was, said I'll just quote this, when I go out and give talks, I ask people how many of you think that the air quality in Salt Lake is worse than it was 20 years ago. 80% of the people raise their hands. He says it's actually the opposite.
Yeah, that's true. That is true. I mean, our air quality is getting better over time. That is facts. Like, we have data to show that. I mean, a lot of it is like other federal regulations, right? On like more efficient cars, cleaner gasoline and fuels. That's really helped our air quality improve over time. I mean, once upon a time in the Salt Lake Valley, people heated their homes by burning coal. Can you imagine the amount of smog and pollution that created? So yeah, our air quality definitely has improved over time. So that's another positive takeaway.
All right, Leah Larson, Water and Land Use reporter, has been telling us about these stories. Thank you, Leah.
You bet.
We'll have Leah back with Underplayed Stories later in the program. We're going to head toward a break on Behind the Headlines, weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Following the break, here's the headline. In water-strapped southern Utah, tighter limits may spell the end for new golf courses. We'll be talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brooke Larson. Hope you stay with us through the break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. And we bring in next Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brooke Larson. Brooke, thank you so much.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Hi, thank you. Here's the headline. In water-strapped southern Utah, tighter limits may spell the end for new golf courses. Of course, St. George area has golf courses. But the Washington County Water Conservancy District's board passed a new policy. What is the policy?
Yeah, so going forward, the top 1% of commercial, institutional, and industrial water users, which includes things like golf courses, will have to go through an additional review with the board, a committee of mayors and managers from the different cities and towns the district serves. And that board will, yeah, review these large water users under a series of tests and decide whether that can go through or not.
So if you have a new project you want to do, so what's the limit that or above which you would have to have this special review?
Yeah, so the district determined that the top 1% of water users in the area consume 9 million gallons a year or more. Golf courses consume a lot more than that, in the hundreds of millions of gallons a year. So, but that 9 million gallons is the threshold, and if you do consume more than that, then you have to prove to this committee that you're going to put that water to, a good use for the public, that you're going to use like the most efficient technology that you can, and also that you're putting that water to good economic use.
So it's the water guzzling industries, golf courses, you just said, a lot of water, data centers, I think we know, and bottling plants, which I hadn't thought of.
Yeah, that was one of the other ones the district kind of pointed out. If, say, a water bottling plant or some other sort of bottling plant wanted to come in, that would be another example of a business that could use a lot of water, and be, in that case, shipping the water out of the county.
So why this scrutiny on the top 1%?
Yeah, I mean, Doug Bennett, the conservation manager for the district, told me that those top 1% of users use almost as much water as the other 99%. And if another golf course gets approved, if another large water user gets approved, that could really affect this area's long-term water strategy. I think a lot of people are aware that, Utah on the whole is in a drought, but, Washington County doesn't have much water left to go around. And so the county is getting very serious about water conservation, new reuse facilities, things like that. And another large water user could really disrupt not only the water supply right now, but these long-term water plans.
So to be clear, if you're a current golf course, you're okay, or other big plant.
Yes, under this policy, you are. So this just affects new development. So if you're, applying to, build a new golf course in the St. George area, you would have to go through this committee if, I guess to qualify on that, if you will be using water that's delivered by the district. Some of the large projects we've seen that have gotten quite a bit of scrutiny, like these surf communities, like Southern Shores, that my colleague down in Southern Utah, Mark Eddington, wrote about recently. They had their own private water rights, and those are regulated by the state, not the district. So if an entity has their own water rights, it's a different story. But if a golf course is trying to use the district's water, then they'll have to go through this.
I understand housing projects, subdivisions are exempt from this.
Yeah, so the district has passed, some policies already that regulate new housing development quite a lot in terms of like limits on lawns and, efficient appliances and things like that. There is, an exception to that in terms of if a housing development wanted to build a golf course or a water park. Those like amenities would be regulated under this policy or need additional review. It's just that in the houses themselves, there's already policies existing to encourage or require conservation measures there.
So golf kind of makes the headline here. You talk to someone representing golf industry. What are they saying?
Yeah, so I mean, they acknowledge that golf uses a lot of water, and golf courses are trying to be more efficient with their sprinkler systems and things like that, but that there's no possible future where a golf course could use less than 9 million gallons per year in Utah is what they said to me. But acknowledging that golf adds some benefits to the community. I mean, in the St. George area, obviously it attracts tourists, both, novice golfers to professional golfers. The Black Desert Resort has hosted the PGA Tour's Bank of Utah Championship the last 2 years. And according to the Greater Zion Tourism Office, that's generated, over $170 million in economic impact for the area last year. But I think one reason that golf courses going forward may have a hard time proving their, economic contribution or public interest is just when you look at the economic output generated per, say, gallon of water, it's actually not that much. And that's what this policy is really looking at, is how much economic productivity will this, commercial industrial project have per gallon of water used.
Environmentalists are saying they would like that limit, 9 million, what is it, gallons per day, to
Per
be
year.
to oh, per year. They would like that to be lower.
Yeah, so I talked with Karen Goodfellow at Conserve Southwest Utah, and they're supportive of this policy, happy to see what the district is doing and in terms of water conservation. Some of the cities that are part of the district, opted to even have their threshold lower at 5 million gallons per year. Cities like Leverkin and Tocqueville near Zion National Park, And Conserve Southwest Utah thought that was a more reasonable threshold for, the whole region. So they ideally would have liked to see all top water users going towards to that level.
Just one more thing on this story, Brooke. Tell me about some of the other conservation measures the board has mandated over the past few years.
Yeah, so I mean the big one, is lawns. New sort of commercial developments can't have lawns unless it's in situations like, a daycare center where you have a lawn for, kids recreating or a sports facility. Households, there's a limit on the square feet you can have lawns. There's also for, new home or existing homeowners, I should say, incentives to rip up your lawn and replace that with water efficient plants. And this past year, the St. George area outpaced Vegas in per capita, number of people per capita switching their lawns. So I mean, it's a somewhat unfair comparison in that Vegas has been doing this for a lot longer. So, they are at the point where it's sort of the most challenging water users to get to change their landscape. And in the St. George area, you're really at the kind of low-hanging fruit point. But, things are changing down there. I think that's not always known across the state that the area is actually trying to do quite a lot of work to change their water use.
We're talking with Brooke Larson on Behind the Headlines. One more story here, Brooke, in this segment. Here's the headline: as the shutdown ends, a long recovery begins at Zion National Park. So, what sorts of things are we looking at? I guess one of the big things that I noticed in the story, lost revenue, right? Then that's just lost, right?
Yep, so during this shutdown, national parks couldn't collect entrance fees from visitors. And so Natalie Britt, the CEO of Zion Forever Project, which is the nonprofit partner for Zion National Park, estimated that the park lost $1.7 million in fee revenue just during October. They're still calculating their estimate for November. So, that's significant. That's money that could go to things like trail maintenance. Fee revenue covers the shuttle service in Zion National Park. So even though people, I heard park rangers were happy to be back at work, it sounds like it's going to be kind of a long road ahead to figure out how to make up for that lost revenue.
What are some of the other issues that they're concerned about as they come back?
I mean, I think there's just this uncertainty still, right? I mean, the bill that was passed in the shutdown only funds the government through the end of January. And in general, we've seen cuts to Park Service, 25% less employees in the Park Service. So I think there's just concerns that in addition to the lost fee revenue, that the park will see larger congressional budget cuts as well, and just the uncertainty, the difficulty to plan and figure out what the next steps are, given that the government currently is only funded through the end of January.
That's true. Yeah, we may be looking at this again in February. So the state of Utah stepped in. They kept some visitor centers open. I'm guessing they're not going to get reimbursed for that money.
Yeah, that's what that they said that they wouldn't be reimbursed. And if you look at the National Parks contingency plan for the shutdown, it does say that, third parties such as states or nonprofits won't be reimbursed for money they put forward. We'll see how that plays out. It sounds like there's maybe some uncertainty on that, but the state doesn't think they will get reimbursed for that.
I don't know. I don't think this was in the story, but I don't know if you know, Brooke, if visitorship, did that decline or was it steady or increase during the furlough, during the shutdown?
The visitor, at least from what I heard from Natalie Britt with Zion Forever, and also, talked to the mayor of Springdale, Barbara Bruno, the visitorship seemed to stay pretty on track with what they'd expect for this time of year. October was quite busy. When I went into Zion, the Springdale, the town right outside, there were hotels that said no vacancy. Talked with restaurant owners, said it was still busy. So I don't think at least Zion and the communities around saw sort of like a decline in visitors. There weren't like a lot of people who canceled their trips or things like that. So yeah, luckily that stayed pretty steady.
Well, thank you. We've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brooke Larson. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Tom.
And coming up following a break, here's the story we'll be talking about. Utah's plan for a massive homeless shelter draws heat from advocates and community leaders. We'll be talking with Salt Lake Tribune Westside Communities reporter Jose Davila IV. You are listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. More following this break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We turn next to Salt Lake Tribune Westside Communities reporter Jose Davila IV. Jose, thank you.
Thanks for having me, Tom. Excited to talk.
Good to talk with you. Here's the headline. Utah's plan for a massive homeless shelter draws heat from advocates and community leaders. It's your story this week with Brock Marchant. So this was a, I don't know, it was a demonstration or a, there was several speeches given. Who was there? Who was speaking?
So yeah, this was a news conference really, hosted by a coalition of opponents or maybe even skeptics of this new massive planned homeless shelter that Utah plans to build in the North Point neighborhood of Salt Lake City. It was an interesting group of people. It was people concerned about the wetlands that are on the site and losing those. There are people who live in the neighborhood around the site, concerned what could happen to the neighborhood if this campus gets built. There are also folks concerned about the state's, well, a specific one, specifically one state leader's proposal to boost involuntary detention and civil commitment and have some of those beds at this site. And then there were homeless services advocates who just plain thought the thing wouldn't work and that it wouldn't help solve the problem. So it's an interesting coalition of folks all talking about sort of issues they see with this plan.
Give us a little idea of the scale of this. This is proposed to be a pretty large place.
Correct. So the current working plan is that the state would like to build a 1,300 bed shelter. They call it a homeless campus because they want to surround that shelter with services that are offered to those folks there on site, stuff like case management, housing, healthcare, that sort of thing. This is a big change for the state, mostly because after the Operation Rio Grande in the late 2010s, the state went to a scattered site homeless services model. So right now in the Salt Lake Valley, there are three homeless resource centers, as well as a couple other shelters that serve subpopulations like families or those who need medical assistance. And those shelters are maxed out at 300 beds. So this would be a really big sort of facility to manage and would host a lot of people. So that's a big change. Also, this talk of putting some civil commitment beds. Civil commitment is the process by which somebody can be told to go to treatment and be required to go to treatment, whether that's for drug treatment or mental health treatment, by a judge because they haven't gone to one of those treatment facilities themselves. And so you know, that the talk of adding those types of beds at this facility is relatively new and was pitched by Utah Homeless Services Board Chair Randy Shumway in a recent meeting at a legislative committee. So there's still a lot up in the air, but generally speaking, this thing's going to be big.
We'll talk about that. That's big sticking point for some folks opposing this facility, right? Involuntary, the civil commitments. Has that been part of any of the homeless shelters in Utah or really anywhere before?
My understanding is that this has not been a part of the state's homeless services system, especially, you know, at all being included in the footprint of the existing shelters. Most of the people that are civilly committed, I believe, stay at the Utah State Hospital as they're getting better and as they're receiving treatment. But yeah, this could be a big change and does pose some problems or issues to solve with building out this campus in terms of, you know, if this is a low barrier congregate shelter, right, where everybody sleeps in the same room, that might not be the best design for something like this, right? And the state's still figuring that out.
It's interesting, Pastor Dusty Trent, you quote from story, Murray Baptist Church, I guess he's a recovering addict himself. He doesn't like this idea of involuntary commitment. He said his own journey, he had to come to that on his own.
Yeah, and I think a lot of these opponents who spoke on Tuesday had a similar view that, you know, this might not actually solve the problem here, because we need people to take this first step, for lack of a better term, for themselves. And so I'm not entirely sure what the how the data bears that out, but it's certainly something opponents are concerned about, and you know, criticizing the state for, you know, involuntarily more or less detaining people, if that is in fact the point.
Bill Tippetts with Crossroads Urban Center said he characterized this new facility as being designed to be a one-size-fits-all model. He said that's a problem.
Yeah, it's he thinks it's a problem because, in his view, the homeless resource centers and the other kind of pockets, the other smaller shelters that make up Utah's homeless services system, especially in the Salt Lake Valley, they're relatively successful. In at this press conference, he said, you know, 26% of the people who go to a homeless shelter in Salt Lake County end up leaving within a week. 75% of those people who go to a homeless shelter find more stable housing in 90 days as well. So, you know, in some ways, the homeless resource centers, as they currently function, work relatively well for the people who can get a bed in them. Obviously, that's a hard part of this. And part of the reason why the state wants to build this big new shelter is that they just need more beds at the bare minimum, so that people aren't sleeping on the street. And they know once they get people in beds, some of those people, most of those people within 3 months, will be able to find a better situation, you know, through the help of the state, in certainly some cases. So he doesn't want this facility, this new shelter, to be narrowly tailored necessarily to the people with the most serious needs, with the most serious mental health conditions, with, you know, with those who need a drug treatment, et cetera. What I think I think that's where his concern lies, because that wouldn't necessarily help those people that just need a quicker hand up, without necessarily needing more heavier wraparound services.
Some of the residents in this North Point area are upset not only with this proposed homeless shelter, but other industry encroaching, because they say they moved there because it was one of the last rural agricultural open pockets in the Salt Lake City area.
Yeah, this neighborhood's really interesting. It for those who are unfamiliar, it's just to the west of I-215 and just north of the airport. It's really, really in the far northwestern corner of the city. Well, actually, I guess the far northern part of the city. The city, of course, stretches basically all the way out to the shoreline of the Great Salt Lake out near Magna, just north of Magna. But this, it's really kind of a one street neighborhood full of ranches and farming. It's a historic farming neighborhood. It's perhaps best known for this farm called Crossy Ranch that, you know, kind of does agritourism. They host, you know, pumpkin patches and so forth. It was recently annexed into Salt Lake City and has long been eyed by developers as a place to build both warehouses and manufacturing facilities because of its proximity to the highway. And so in many ways, this neighborhood is changing right before our eyes, and residents feel like this homeless campus is just one more thing that's doing that. They also have public safety concerns, right? They feel that this campus, this facility will bring more crime to their neighborhood, will bring more insecurity to their neighborhood. They're fearful of, you know, I've talked to some homeowners, they're fearful of people, you know, sleeping in their barns, right? A lot of them have barns, a lot of them have livestock, and so on and so forth, when they can't, you know, get a bed necessarily at this facility. So it's been a hot topic for sure.
Some are concerned about environmental concerns, wetlands nearby apparently.
Yeah, so the site has a couple of small wetlands, and Dita Seed, who is a representative of the nonprofit Center for Biological Diversity, said that those wetlands are included in the shoreline area preservation plan related to the Great Salt Lake, and so would like to protect them, right? Because obviously that's a great place for birds. It's a part of this larger ecosystem around the Great Salt Lake. In a later meeting on Tuesday, the state homelessness coordinator, Wayne Niederhauser, who's retiring, by the way, early next month, he told Salt Lake City Council members that those wetlands, and they're relatively small, maybe just under an acre of a 15-acre site, that those wetlands are non-jurisdictional. Which basically means under federal law that they are not connected to any other waterway or waters of the United States, and therefore have less protection from development impacts. Now that's just something he said. That's a study that the state has done. The state has sent that study to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which will have the final say on what sort of protections or how to define those wetlands.
Wayne Niederhauser also said his office is looking for input on this homeless campus. I guess they're open.
Yes. You know, this was kind of a big fight. The state basically decided not to take input on this campus idea until they found a site. And now that they found a site, now that they have said this thing is going here, we're now more than happy to take input from the community, from partner organizations, from service providers, from local governments about what this campus should do and should be. And so him going to the Salt Lake City Council on Tuesday evening was a part of that. You know, council members talked about what they wanted to see, how they wanted to, you know, wanted to make sure that you know, this new shelter would be safe for both the people inside and the people and the neighbors outside. And hit on a couple other themes. One council member, Dan Dugan, who represents District 6, kind of in the eastern foothills of the city, he was concerned about this mix of involuntary and voluntary beds, and said, hey, let's design this in a way that works. So they are taking feedback now. Just yesterday, the Homeless Services Board met and received presentations from a bunch of stakeholders, including Salt Lake City, as well as Salt Lake County, a service provider, the Other Side Academy, and a handful of other kind of homelessness experts and local governments that work on homelessness about what this campus should look like. And there's some division. There's some different ideas about what this campus can and should do.
All right. Well, thank you for telling us about this. We won't have time to talk about a second story that we were, but I'll just read the headline. Popular Salt Lake City bar shuttered by a blaze that tore through its historic downtown buildings. It's on the cusp of reopening. Go and read that of Jose's at sltrib.com. Update on that tragic fire. So it's time for Underplayed Stories of the Week here on Behind the Headlines. We'll start with Leah Larson. What's your underplayed story?
So mine was written by my colleague Brock Marchant on Sunday. The Oaks in Ogden Canyon has reopened. It's like a century-old institution up there, and it's been closed for a while. So it's fun to see it reopen, and it's always great to have a spot to grab an ice cream or some lunch after you've been playing in the mountains or at Pineview Reservoir. So I'm excited about that personally.
All right. SLTrib.com to read that one. Brooke Larson, what's your underplayed story?
Yeah, I wanted to highlight some of the coverage my colleague down in Southern Utah, Mark Eddington, has been doing on some of the, like, a new local distillery as well as a new packaged liquor store. Last week, there was a story, Short Creek Business Distilling Area's Polygamous Past and Promising Future with Spirits, Not Words. I think it's just an interesting look into how this, you know, part of Southern Utah, the Short Creek area, which consists of, you know, Colorado City, kind of polygamous history there is often what gets the news, but there's a new distillery there that's kind of bringing this other new culture. So I think that's an interesting look into Southern Utah.
All right. Read Mark's story there at sltrib.com. Jose, what's your underplayed story of the week?
I really enjoyed Jordan Miller's story. The headline, Utah Creamery defaced over its sale of a controversial product. It's a great lead to nerd out on journalism. It's a great way to draw people into the story. I won't spoil it for you. Please go read it. But basically, it's about this creamery that sells raw milk and got vandalized because of that.
Yeah. Yeah, check that out at sltrib.com. All the stories we've been talking about today as well, sltrib.com. Well, we've been talking on Behind the Headlines today to Salt Lake Tribune water and land use reporter Leah Larson. Leah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.
You too. Thank you. Reporter Brooke Larson has been with us. Brooke, thank you.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you. And reporter Westside Communities reporter Jose Davila IV has been with us. Thanks, Jose.
Thanks for having me, Tom. Have a good one.
Thank you. And thanks, everyone, for listening. You've been listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Hope you'll join us again next time.